From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield. This was the week that Facebook got caught committing journalism?
Facebook says its users determine what topics are trending. But new claims suggest that may not be the case all the time.
Facebook's trending news section isn't actually determined by a computer algorithm, but by Facebook workers.
What's trending on Facebook? Liberalism.
The tech site Gizmodo, based on whistleblower testimony, reported that the world's largest social platform has been manipulating its supposedly algorithmically generated trending story feature with human intervention, either to make up for the tin ear of computer code or to inject political bias or both.
According to one of our sources, conservative news was suppressed regularly.
Michael Nunez broke the story for Gizmodo.
This particular curator kept a running list for the course of 6 months because he felt so uncomfortable with how frequently conservative news topics were being blacklisted. Another revelation that we discovered was that these curators are using something called an injection tool. And in those cases, they're plugging news stories into Facebook's trending news that aren't naturally trending at all.
Facebook this week categorically denied using curators to advance an anti-conservative agenda, but it also denied having a so-called injection tool. And then the Guardian newspaper released leaked Facebook documents instructing curators on such a tool's use. So at a minimum, the company has some serious explaining to do. The question is, how much and to whom? Republican Senator John Thune of South Dakota, chair of the Senate Commerce Committee, wrote to Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg demanding accountability.
If the news that's coming through there, which is represented to be objective, and it's not, then I think the people deserve the right to know that. And so it's just a question of having them clarify, you know, how they go about doing this, if in fact, what is their policy, and if their policy has been breached, what they've done to correct that.
Due to a quaint little loophole known as the First Amendment, of course, a publisher has no accountability whatsoever to Congress or any other institution of government if no libel or crime has been committed. Indeed, back in 2007, a prominent senator wrote, quote, "I know the hair stands up on the back of my neck when I hear government officials offering to regulate the news media." That senator was John Thune. The twist is that Facebook loudly claims not to be a news publisher, but rather a platform, a vast, ubiquitous platform that routinely has business with legislators and regulators. It's a conundrum, all right. And also, despite the media tempest that this week broke out, maybe a red herring. As we shall see in this segment, when it comes to social media as distributor of news, the gaming of trending stories lists may be the least of our worries. Emily Bell, a professor at Columbia Journalism School and previously director of digital content at The Guardian, is watching with some trepidation a radical reordering of the media landscape. Emily, welcome.
Thank you, Bob.
This is all about Facebook, Google, and Apple as arbiters of what we, the audience, will consume. But you could argue, and in fact, I think you have argued, that it really starts with the social media app favored by millennials called Snapchat.
Just over a year ago, this new app called Snapchat, which has a mere 100 million users, launched something called Snapchat Discover. And when you look at it on your mobile phone, it's a channel within the app itself. There are a dozen channels or so, and they're taken up by brands like Cosmo and Vice and the Daily Mail and various other media brands. And within that, you have these stories.
They're not linked to the publisher's own webpages.
Exactly.
They reside within the app.
Yes. This is the first time we've seen a social app say, right, we're going to allow publishers to reach this vast new audience, but it's much better for the users and for the publishers if the stories live here rather than linking out. And that kicked off a whole chain of events whereby other competing publishers, notably Facebook, really kind of revved up this idea that they would follow suit and get publishers to publish within their apps as well. And if you're reading news, you'll barely notice it. But if you're reading news on Facebook and you go to an article and it loads very quickly and it looks very nice, you know, if you look carefully, you'll notice that you haven't left the Facebook environment. And this is news. This is Facebook Instant Articles. Then we saw Apple News launch something very similar. And then we saw Google launch something called Accelerated Mobile Pages.
The uproar of the Facebook trending revelation seems to assume that human intervention is corrupt and algorithmic decisions are neutral and pure. But EdgeRank, which is Facebook's algorithm, is itself biased by design, not politically, but to literally serve the user's interests and Facebook's itself.
If you regularly consume your news just through Facebook, you will see a repetitive nature to the kinds of stories that you get shown. And that's a way in which the algorithmic sorting, if you like, sort of gets rid of serendipity, doesn't really know quite how accurately to guess at what we're thinking or what it might be good for us to see next. So we live inside this thing that the entrepreneur and web thinker Eli Pariser coined as being the filter bubble.
Now, it was sneaky about it and disingenuous, and I guess it mislabeled trending topics as having somehow been algorithmically organic as opposed to editorially enhanced, let's say. But if I understand what you're saying correctly, in terms of fear and outrage about what Facebook represents, focusing on the trending box is the right church but wrong pew.
You know, I think that it is ironic that Facebook is now at the center of the eye of this media storm. It's exposing in several ways because it means that, first of all, in our popular imagination, we are thinking that trending topics are somehow fair because they are automatic and they've been decided by math. But as any good statistician will tell you, there are biases in statistics and numbers and algorithms as well. But what it has exposed is that people haven't really been cognizant enough of what the overall kind of influence and possibilities are of having a news ecosystem now, which is effectively dictated by the behaviors of these very big platform companies. And in a way, it's an excellent piece of news that we are at least now having that debate, even if we're having it on, if you like, a slightly faulty footing.
And certainly the influence of the Facebook newsfeed is not to be sneezed at. Can you tell me about the 2010 voter turnout experiment?
Voters were shown messages to see whether or not, just by reminding, if you like, people to vote, there was any impact at all on voter turnout, and there was a detectable uptick. Now, you might say, well, that's pretty straightforward and uncontroversial. Now, if Facebook is able to prompt and increase voter turnout, but we don't know whether it's doing that holistically or whether it's doing it partially, then that obviously may well have political consequences. If somebody puts an advert on TV telling us to go and vote, there are contracts between broadcasters and political advertisers that we can scrutinize and see where the money is spent. On Facebook, all of that is obscure. And so much of the brouhaha this week has been about this opacity. So in many ways, we're not talking about particularly new problems for gatekeepers, but we are talking about a very new problem in terms of being able to interrogate, you know, how these decisions are arrived at. And if there's any accountability for the actions that these companies take, you know, all of this language and the way that these companies have framed this behavior have created this expectation of somehow sort of equality of access. And now it appears that that's not actually the case. And of course, if we think about it for 2 seconds, it could never have been the case.
I have to ask you, considering the influence that Facebook has, presumably on elections and everything else, what scenario for the future in publishers' relationships with social media for you looks most ominous?
What feels most problematic at the moment is just this lack of transparency. So we already have this odd relationship where news companies that ought to be holding the power to account are actually now subsumed in a really extensive new system of power. So we've got to kind of solve this conundrum in a way by agreeing that there has to be a greater level of transparency, because I think without that, you really do start to lose the essence of what makes democracy function well. And I think, you know, if we don't grasp the moment and maybe make some interventions, then it runs the risk of calcifying into a set of new practices which are actually even more obscure and potentially more corrupt than what we've had in the past.
Emily, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob.
Emily Bell is professor at the Columbia University School of Journalism. Robert McChesney is professor of communication at the University of Illinois. He has devoted his career to studying the effects of big media. Bob, welcome to the show.
My pleasure to be here.
First, I want to go back down memory lane and discuss the question of media concentration as you first studied it and wrote about it decades ago in the old analog days.
What took place in the 70s, 80s, and 90s was the consolidation of what were at one time several hundred independent, oftentimes competitive media into a system dominated by, you know, six or seven giant conglomerates and then another two dozen or so smaller scale conglomerates.
Then what happened was the internet came along and at least seemed for about 20 years to make the fears seem less relevant, because after all, the internet was going to be the ultimate democratization. Millions and millions and millions of independent voices, all accessible from anywhere in the world.
In fact, in the mid-1990s, John Perry Barlow, the lyricist for the Grateful Dead, who became sort of a famous cyber democracy advocate, wrote a manifesto in which he said, we don't have to worry about the Rupert Murdochs and the Time Warners of the world, because all they're doing is rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. The iceberg they're about to hit is the internet with its tens of millions, even billions of websites, basically making media conglomerates irrelevant in the near future. And that was a common belief, I think, in the 1990s. That was a conviction. There's been an element of truth to it, to the extent that the internet has revolutionized our lives. And it means that it gives us access to a broad range of information that would have been unthinkable 25 years ago or 20 years ago that we get today and we take for granted. The downside was that what the internet also did is it removed the business model for commercial journalism upon which journalism had been based for 125 years in the United States, and it offered nothing to replace it. And so that crisis has grown much more severe as a result of the internet. It hasn't been solved by the internet.
Do your concerns from the 70s and 80s, do they seem trifling now? Do they seem quaint?
Well, you know, they seem really of a piece. They're just the earlier stage of where we are now. The media giants, the conglomerates that were built up by the end of the 20th century that are still around today, CBS, News Corporation, Disney, they were sort of like the equivalent of the Ozark Mountains. Now we're talking about the largest companies that dominate the whole internet economy are the most valuable companies in the world today: Google, Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, Facebook. These companies are much more like the Himalayas compared to the Ozarks. They completely overwhelm our society. And they're very much monopolies in the classic sense that Standard Oil was a monopoly under John D. Rockefeller, in that they really do not have to fear for going out of business, and they can control how much competition they have by how serious they want to dominate their market. And they let enough competition in as needed to protect their profitability. And it creates a fundamental problem for society. What do you do when you have these massive private firms that dominate the economy and have the resources to dominate the government and influence what the government does to their benefit? And this has been a recurring problem in the United States since the Gilded Age of the late 19th century. And now it's come back with a vengeance today in a way completely unlike anything we saw throughout the 20th century.
All right, you said the M word. And the U.S. government broke up Standard Oil on antitrust grounds. Is that the remedy for the concentration of power on the internet that we're witnessing now?
It might be, but there's also the argument, and this is an argument made ironically by conservative economists more than liberal and left-wing economists, including Henry Simons, who was Milton Friedman's mentor at the University of Chicago, that when you get a private monopoly that's so large that you can't break it up effectively because it'll return to becoming a monopoly again within a few years, what you have to do is take it out of the market system and make it some sort of post office or government-run or municipally-run enterprise so that it's not dominating other smaller businesses, it's not dominating consumers, and worst of all, it's not dominating the government through its sort of power over legislators and government decisions.
You're saying nationalizing Facebook, or have I missed something there?
Nationalizing is a loaded word. That term suggests you've got a central committee and someone speaking of the foreign accent coming in and crudely bossing everyone around is completely unaccountable. But you can have systems that are nonprofit, that are run, that are accountable, and that are effective. The BBC is nationalized, right? The U.S. Post Office is nationalized. Public schools in most cities are municipalized. And Simon's point, as a conservative economist, was that if you allow private monopolies to grow really large, they will distort capitalism, the system he loved, and make it incapable of being a functional system because they will dominate the whole economy and the government and turn the governance very corrupt. I think he's raising issues that we've got to take very seriously. Going back to Louis Brandeis of the Supreme Court, to Clarence Darrow and the great battles over the railroads and Standard Oil, and we can't put our head in the sand about them. We're going to have to deal with them at some point.
Well, let's just say that without putting our head in the sand, that it's a political non-starter for the next decade at least to really consider taking these juggernauts of Silicon Valley and somehow rendering them into public utilities. Is there another way to approach media concentration that is more politically practical?
Yeah, there is, and I agree with you. The idea is not politically feasible at all in our times, in our immediate times, for the reasons Simons and Brandeis outlined, which is these companies have immense political power with both parties, and so challenging them is going to be extraordinarily difficult. That doesn't mean you can't do anything. We can enforce network neutrality on the cartel that offers internet service provision, Comcast, AT&T, and Verizon. They still keep all their money, their profits, their power, but they can't abuse their power to such an extent that they can discriminate against websites. We've stopped that. And there are a number of other measures we can do against surveillance, for privacy, that would keep the system intact, but also protect our interest. And then finally, for the issue that, Bob, you and I both care about so much, we could do a lot to promote and extend journalism that these companies could then help us, you know, distribute the material through their various algorithms and services. They are not an impediment to that whatsoever.
Are you suggesting that they can and should defeat the central populism of the newsfeed, giving us more and more of the yummy stuff that we like to consume, and force feed us broccoli and green vegetables and legislative votes on redistricting and so forth?
The last thing I want is Facebook or any other company patronizing us, nor would I want someone enforcing that on those companies either. And I also am a big believer that people will demand information as it's important to the world they see and the world they want to be in. And part of the reason why it seems like people would regard information about the economy or politics as to be broccoli as opposed to apple pie or pizza is that they feel somewhat powerless. So it's sort of like boring information that doesn't really have any value to them because they have no control over those sort of decisions or that world. So it's better to learn about the New England Patriots' defensive secondary than it is about, you know, trade policy. And I think as people get more interested in politics, their taste grows and they'll start demanding more information of value to them.
Public policy is an acquired taste. You don't actually have any evidence of that, have you?
Yeah, I do. I think it's all around us right now. It's one of the most interesting stories of our times right now is that there's been a real surge of interest in politics among young people in this country in the last it's grown gradually over the last 15 years, but especially in the last 3 to 5 years, much greater than what I saw when I was a young person in the late 70s or in the 80s or 90s. And as this happens, there's a lot more interest in learning more about the world. And so I think you see that on social media. I'm experiencing it. I see it in my classroom. So I think we're in a moment right now where there's actually a genuine hunger to learn more about the world and the frustration with the lack of information people are getting.
Bob, thank you so much.
My great pleasure.
Robert McChesney is an author and professor of communication at the University of Illinois. Coming up, accountability the analog way. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. In 2012, the New York Times hired its first ever female public editor, then editor of the Buffalo News, Margaret Sullivan. Now, 4 years later, having become the Times' longest-serving ombudsperson, Sullivan is leaving for a job as media columnist at the Washington Post. In a pair of swan song pieces, she expressed some ambivalence about public editorship because, it turns out, being part reader advocate and part internal affairs investigator takes its toll.
I've heard the public editor job described as the worst job in journalism, but it actually was a great job and an incredible privilege. And I, on balance, had a pretty good time doing it.
No one ever keyed your car or slashed your tires or anything?
I made sure to get rid of my car, so there was no opportunity to do that, but that could easily have happened.
Nonetheless, some ambivalence. You did a blog post that was titled, Five Things I Won't Miss at the Times and Seven I Will.
Yes.
Well, let's first discuss what was just fantastic about your experiences.
Trend stories in the style section, which I've actually had a little bit of fun with, lightly mocking, on something I called my monocle meter. The original monocle meter inspiration was a story about the supposed resurgence of the monocle being worn largely in Brooklyn, but elsewhere in the greater New York area. There was actually pretty good data in the story about this happening. But again, I never did see this on the street or the subway or anyplace else.
So thank God for the New York Times.
To tell us.
Now then, let us turn to the Times habits or tics that seem to irritate you quite a bit. The first is the question of New York Times exceptionalism.
Mm-hmm.
The second being the complaint that insufficient editorial resources sometimes keep us from covering everything that the paper of record needs to cover.
Well, there is a feeling that when the Times decides to cover it, then it becomes news. I mean, that's true to a certain extent, and I don't want to exaggerate, but I pick some of that up.
For example, the Panama Papers very recently.
Yes.
The Times took a pass for about 48 hours while the rest of the world was going nuts.
And then you could ask, why wasn't the Times part of that consortium? The answer to that lies in something that they require from news organizations called radical sharing. And I don't know that radical sharing is actually something that the New York Times is all that interested in.
And resources?
You know, one issue that came up was the water crisis in Flint, Michigan, which the Times wrote an early story or two on, but never really dug into. The answer I got was, we can't cover every local story. And that's true. But I thought they missed an opportunity to really do some good there.
Now, that's diplomatic. In your piece, you twisted the knife a little bit and said, well, you didn't have resources to give Flint. But you did manage to cover Hillary Clinton's campaign 3 years before the first primary.
Now, would that same reporter have done a story on Flint? I mean, I don't really think you can draw a straight line, but I think at times better choices could be made.
Did you find that reporters and editors were grudgingly accepting of your judgments, were churlish about it?
Oh, not churlish.
Regarded it as a teachable moment and they felt gratified?
No.
How would you describe it?
I would say that there was something like grudging acceptance of the idea that the readers have had something to say and the public editor may be seeing their point of view. But if it's your thing, and this is human nature, including my own, no one likes to be criticized, so that's no fun.
In your farewell piece, you talked about, my words, not yours, the slippery slope in the matter of social distribution, letting Facebook instant articles and similar social platforms have an increasing role in getting New York Times stories, and by the way, the Washington Post is very bullish on this as well, in front of readers. Good news is the stories get much larger audiences, and even better news is it fetches fairly handsome ad rates, which otherwise have been plummeting for 10 years. But there's a very great risk to that.
Well, Facebook is going to present things to you based not on an editor's judgment of what's newsworthy or what's important or what has social value, but according to algorithms which say,
I have demonstrated an interest in that particular kind of story before, or yes, my social graph has shown an interest in it, or the general Facebook audience thinks it's just plain fascinating.
That's right. All those things. We start to see only the things that we're already interested in and that we already agree with. You know, it's an echo chamber for yourself, and that can feed our own prejudices and keep us from being as well-informed as we need to be good citizens.
The slippery slope is a bit slipperier still because the New York Times management, which will make more money from clickbaity stories that fly through social media than it will from perhaps the more good-for-you doctor's-ordered stories, will have a very real decision to make about whether to continue to produce the kind of high-quality, low-pyrotechnic journalism that we need as a society, because nobody's looking at it anyway because the Facebook algorithm isn't feeding it to anybody.
There's evidence that consumers of news are very interested in high-quality journalism as well. Sure, they're interested in kitty videos and Kardashians. But, you know, this story that ran a few months ago in the Times by Sonny Kleinfeld called The Lonely Life of George Beall, which was about a man who died alone in his apartment in Queens, was extremely detailed and long and extraordinarily well-read. So it gives me hope that great work is appreciated work as well.
So you're going to the Post, where you will be not an ombudsperson, but a columnist.
Yes, that's a very important distinction.
But I imagine periodically you'll be writing pieces that very much involve the Washington Post as well. And I got an idea for you.
Okay.
I saw a piece. It was the best read story on Washington Post that day. Mm-hmm. And the headline was this: doctors were startled to find the cause of this 24-year-old's excruciating pain. And it turned out that the cause was a tumor, the least startling cause you could imagine. And it was, you know, so clearly following the social media formula of generating audience. And where you're going, there's no public editor to yelp about it. Are you going to take up the cause on this kind of thing?
I am going to resist the role of public editor or ombudsperson in every way I can. But there could be a broader piece about many news organizations doing the kinds of stories that are intended to drive audience and what that's doing to the journalism. The Times now has something called the Express Team, which sets out to do stories that are in the social media conversation. The Times will have a version of that story so that you're not reading about it on BuzzFeed. News organizations are struggling to figure out what works.
Margaret, thank you very, very much.
You're welcome.
Margaret Sullivan is the former public editor for the New York Times. Her job as media columnist for the Washington Post starts Monday. Coming up, two candidates and two very different kinds of disgrace. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. In 2011, New York Congressman Anthony Weiner, rising star in the Democratic Party and husband of Hillary Clinton's right-hand woman, Huma Abedin, saw his career implode thanks to one bad tweet.
It all started Friday night at 11:30 p.m.
A photo of an anonymous man's bulging underwear
was tweeted from Congressman Weiner's account.
Tell me definitively, is that a photograph of you?
I'm reluctant to say to you definitively anything about this.
So it's possible.
And we're trying to get to the bottom of what it's of and who it's of.
Weiner denied the charges, then admitted to them, and finally resigned. Another politician brought down by the deadly combination of lust, hubris, and technology. But 2 years later, Weiner was back, this time running for mayor of New York City. He was a new man. He had repented. He wanted to talk about the issues, but the people and the pundits were dubious. As it turned out, They were right. Within a few months, Weiner was once again humiliated by a sexting scandal and forever branded as his nom de plume, Carlos Danger.
Under the screen name...
Carlos Danger.
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 Carlos Danger.
I assume it was to avoid using a ridiculous name like Anthony Weiner.
But before his indiscretions dashed his career for a second time, Weiner agreed to let a pair of documentary filmmakers record his campaign, indeed his entire life, hoping that they would capture not his downfall, but his redemption. Elise Steinberg is a writer and documentary film director. Josh Kriegman is a director and former political consultant. Together, they produced and directed Weiner. Elise, Josh, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks so much.
You approached this film as the comeback story of a promising young politician who was derailed by a horrendous and or delicious sex scandal. And you begin, really, by taking pains to remind people of Weiner's pre-scandal political reputation, this up-and-coming guy with passion that we seldom see. It sounds something like this.
You vote yes if you believe yes. You vote in favor of something if you believe it's the right thing. If you believe it's the wrong thing, you vote no. We are following a procedure. I will not yield to the gentleman, and the gentleman will observe regular order.
It was important for us to establish, you know, where he had come from. And one of the key things about his history is that he really was a rising star in the Democratic Party.
It was an absolute pleasure to see a Democrat not cowering.
No question, the guy knows how to fight.
He's scrappy, he's combative, he's always been a great fighter on behalf of the people.
He never backed down from anybody.
You should urge them to vote yes, something the gentleman has not done.
He was one of the best in politics at understanding kind of the contours of modern media, whether it's, you know, going viral on YouTube or using Twitter or, you know, clips on cable news.
The tools of modern media, oy vey, they built him up and they, of course, were his undoing. Would you have focused on this campaign had it not been for his kind of sordid history?
When we began filming, we thought this could be a remarkable comeback story. And when we were in the middle of the filming, I guess it was 6 weeks in, Anthony was at the top of the polls. And it would have been an exciting story had he won. But then, obviously, things took an unexpected turn, and our documentary, from a story perspective, changed.
Breaking news just into our newsroom in New York City. The New York mayoral candidate Anthony Weiner sent additional explicit photos and texts to a woman online.
Unexpected turn, Elise? Based on what you knew of him and what you knew from him, you didn't see that coming?
I didn't know Anthony prior to working on this film. Josh had known him, but I didn't. And in many ways, I was just like the audience, watching the events unfold. But what I realized when I met Anthony and I looked through the footage was that I saw a much more complex, nuanced person. And that was the story that we were excited to tell.
And that was the story clearly you pitched to him, right? In order for him to make the fairly counterintuitive move of opening up his entire life to filmmakers in the midst of his attempted comeback.
Yeah, you know, it was a conversation that actually went on over the course of a couple of years. It was right after he resigned from Congress that I started a conversation with him about doing a documentary and telling his story. You know, of course, you know, he was hoping for a comeback story. And in the first 6 weeks of filming, the first half of the campaign or so, despite a lot of pundits counting him out or thinking he was a joke to begin with, he was, you know, rose to the top of the polls. And as filmmakers, we felt we might be capturing really one of the more remarkable comeback stories in American political history.
And then you managed to document one of the most remarkable uncomeback from comebacks.
As documentarians, we couldn't believe that we were there. We couldn't believe that we were in the room while this was unfolding.
The question is, do we answer it or not? I think we have to answer these questions.
I think we have to answer because if somebody else comes out, we don't.
So, okay. So then you're gonna give me an answer.
The greatest documentaries are the ones where you go in with a certain expectation of the story
and then it dramatically changes.
You know, one of the things that we knew going into the story was whatever happens in the headlines and the tabloids and the cable news, the contrast between that and what we were hopefully going to be able to capture behind the scenes, that was something that we knew, you know, however it all unfolded, was what we were excited about capturing in the documentary and what we, in general, what excites us about documentaries.
And then, perhaps most mysteriously, there's Wiener's wife, Huma Abedin. Throughout the film, at various points, she is offering strategy and tactics to him. At other points, she is standing at a podium in front of a press scrum, voicing her support for his candidacy.
When we faced this publicly 2 years ago, it took a lot of work and a whole lot of therapy to get to a place where I could forgive Anthony.
And various other points, she's just sitting there looking really pissed off. This is a moment where her husband is trying to show her an interview he did, a very contentious cable interview, and he's trying to get her take on it.
You knew, Anthony, that you were a gravely damaged candidate.
I said so.
Pretty crazy. Who do you think looks better there, me or him?
Why are you laughing? This is crazy.
It's terribly crazy, but what was I supposed to do? I mean, tell me what I was supposed to do. This is where it continued.
No. Focus on your speech. Get it started for
this makes me feel better. This makes me get more fight in me, less emotional.
Oh, really?
At one point, she mutters about living in a nightmare. Did you feel guilty being an eyewitness to her ongoing nightmare?
One of the things that was really exciting for us was to show what it means to be caught up in a media firestorm, the humanity behind the headlines.
There's so much impulse to judge, especially in the reality of sort of the modern media culture where everything comes through these tiny snippets, tweets, and cable news sound bites and things. It's such a reductive flurry that we get. And so, you know, so much of the intention of the film is to spend some time with these people and to see that it's complicated and that this idea that we could possibly know what's going on, you know, in anybody's relationship, I think is worthy of scrutiny.
And especially, you know, with Huma, there was this judgment against her. Huma, along with many other women, have been criticized for staying with their husbands who have done something wrong or embarrassing.
Huma Abedin, what is the simple explanation for why she decided to get out there in front of this?
I fall back to the Blaise Pascal, the philosopher, who said, the heart has its reasons, of which reason knows nothing.
I counter that with Shakespeare. Has she eaten on the insane root that devours intellect and takes reason prisoner?
And, you know, our film is to question those types of judgments. I mean, shouldn't a woman be able to make her own decisions without judgment? And why should they be judged for decisions made by their flawed husbands? Our hope with this film is to go beyond those judgments and to question them.
One of the most poignant moments in the film, seems to me, comes when Wiener, like many a politician, has utterly lost traction with the voters with Election Day fast approaching. And, you know, he becomes sort of the Black Knight from Monty Python, and he's denying the predicament he's in until he has a very fraught conversation with his pollster.
There's no chance to win anymore. Winning is now defined as, if Anthony wants to continue here, keeping his head high and saying something that matters and getting some at least grudging respect back. I don't think there's a path anymore to get to a runoff. So this is a solo flight.
You know, after the clip that you just played, you know, he jokes about being liberated in a death row kind of way. And I think that when the race was mostly lost and he knew that his chances of victory were slim, you know, it freed him up to continue to go out there and basically just champion what he was fighting for. There's a later scene in City Island in the Bronx where he takes a room that's initially very much opposed to him, and he stands up in front of them and he gives an impassioned speech. And he basically says, I'm not going to go away because this embarrassing thing happened. I'm actually talking about something I care about.
Do you think it was easy? Let's go to City Island knowing that I'd get this question. The reason I did that is because I'm trying to communicate something here. These are my ideas. I care about them. You did something we don't like. Cameras in your face. Change your mind. Back down. Quit. That's not the kind of mayor I'm going to be. So Sir, I say to you with all due respect, do not vote for me, but don't deny these people the right to vote for me.
Much of the depictions of the media in the film are of them just schooling around Wiener, you know, like barracudas around a sick grouper. Are the media a villain in this story or something else?
That's a great question. The media is, without a doubt, a main character in the story. Anthony says this in the film. You know, the media has this rhythm that he's well aware of, and he got into the campaign with his eyes wide open, understanding the way that it might go.
They love stoking it. They love talking about it. They love building me up, having me on their show so they can excoriate me and everything else. But let's make this very clear. I mean, I did the thing, though. So it's not their fault that they played their role. They just were doing, you know, it's the frog and the scorpion.
And I think that's right. I think the media certainly has its role to play, you know, in the way that the political conversation is driven so much by spectacle. But of course, Anthony has his role to play as well. And we as consumers have our role to play.
One of the things that was important to us with this film is that it would go beyond just one person or one campaign, that it would provide a look at how our politics today is just driven by an insatiable appetite for spectacle and entertainment. And we don't have to look very far to see that being played out with Donald Trump. While I think Anthony and Trump are very different politically and personally, I do think that they both understood that in order to be a successful politician in today's 24-hour news cycle, you need to put on a show. By being brash and having an air of authenticity, you get votes.
Well, in case anyone in the audience has forgotten, Election Day came, and Wiener just got absolutely thumped. He ended up with about 5% of the vote. And after that, we see you asking him why the hell would he have sat down with you during this period to begin with. And he literally just shrugs. But a little bit later, you get the answer to your question.
I wanted just to be viewed as the full person that I was. And I can't believe my entire everything is being engulfed by this thing. And maybe that's what happens.
Is that really the truth, do you think?
I think it was the truth. I think it's been said that those that are the most exposed are the least revealed. And that was certainly the case with Anthony.
Look, Anthony, of course, I think we can all sort of recognize is the kind of person who is in some ways more comfortable when a camera is pointed at him. You know, that's an element of who he is. I think in some ways it's an element of our politicians in general. It's kind of a requirement. You know, if you're not excited about seeing your picture in the paper in the morning, you're not going to make it very far. But I'd also say, you know, to what he says to us at the end of the film, you know, remember, he's a really smart guy. He had been through this scandal and media firestorm once already, and he'd had this experience of having his whole reputation, his whole person just entirely wiped out and replaced with this one thing. Having another version of his story documented and told, it might be something that in the end he can appreciate.
I want to play Family Feud. I want you to answer me simultaneously, okay? The question is Anthony Wiener a courageous political leader and public servant or an exhibitionist?
You're gonna hate this response, but I think we have to refuse.
Actually, the answer I was looking for was yes.
I mean, yeah, the answer is yes. I think that's exactly right.
Yes, both, yes.
And that's the point of the film, and obviously that's what you're getting at.
Elise, Josh, thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Elise Steinberg and Josh Kriegman are the directing team behind the new documentary, Wiener, which traces the rise and fall of former New York Congressman Anthony Wiener's 2013 mayoral campaign. It's in theaters this coming week. Oh, looky here. Look who's all of a sudden respectable. Trump, interviewed by the Wall Street Journal on financial policy on Monday and the day before, too, with ABC's George Stephanopoulos.
If you try to buy debt back at a discount, interest rates are going to go up.
No, you can buy
you have
debt
to borrow
back
to pay for
you
it.
Buy debt back and you take advantage of certain things. You can.
The same morning, Donald Trump was on NBC's Meet the Press, where Chuck Todd, to his credit, I suppose, caught him in a flip-flop over his incoherent tax proposals.
Should we assume that most of your plans then, we shouldn't take you at your word as sort of that they're floors, what you just described, that, you know what, it's my opening statement, but everything is negotiable.
Excuse me,
Excuse me. It's called life, Chuck. It's not my word. Of course, I put in a proposal. You know what they are? They're really proposals. People can say it's a tax plan. It's really a tax proposal.
Hold it. Tax policy? Why give that any scrutiny whatsoever, no matter how flip-floppy or incoherent? There are far bigger fish to fry.
They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people.
You know, he may be talking, but he'll talk a lot faster with the torture.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States.
So if you see somebody getting ready to throw a tomato, knock the crap out of them, would you? Seriously.
You know, you could see there was blood coming out of her eyes, blood coming out of her wherever.
How do you know those bruises weren't there before? I'm not a lawyer.
Trump has achieved the brink of the Republican nomination, according to the candidate himself, by being himself, no matter how politically incorrect. Except that his supposed courageous candor is contaminated with the most cowardly hate speech, racism, xenophobia, misogyny, incitement, breathtaking ignorance on issues both foreign and domestic, and a nuclear recklessness reminiscent of a raving meth head with a machete on an episode of Cops.
Bad boys, bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you?
The man is a menace of historic proportions. So who the Chuck Todd cares about his tax proposals? It's like asking Charles Manson about his driving record. But here comes the political press going into standard general election mode and treating a demagogue as a legitimate standard bearer, as if the only thing he has to answer for is the latest blip in the news cycle.
Who will Donald Trump pick as his vice presidential running mate?
All right, just moments ago, Donald Trump arrived in Washington. We saw his plane at Reagan National Airport. At this very moment, he is in an SUV, he's on his way.
Let's just say that we institutionally were obliged till now to report and thus give oxygen to Trump's incendiary ravings, because hate speech is news. It's our role to expose it, even if the exposure serves him. It is not our role, however, to be co-conspirators in his revisionist imagery.
The Republican race for president with a brand new look this morning, a presidential Donald Trump, fresh off a major foreign policy speech.
Today, he decided to act presidential and gave a foreign policy speech, read it from a teleprompter. That's not like Donald Trump. He was tempered in his approach.
But if you listen to Trump last night at his quote-unquote victory speech, we saw the different Trump. We saw the calm Trump, the more presidential Trump.
For crying out loud, of course he wants to be elevated. What's sickening is who's operating the elevator. With every oh-so-decorous question about tax policy or the national debt, the media are not simply abetting him, but normalizing him, in effect accepting his grotesque path to the nomination. Look, by its nature, journalism subordinates old news to the latest development. But in this case, being slave to the fresh angle is simple malpractice, because every moment spent on Trump policy and process buries the lead. The lead is that a man who wants to build a wall, who wants to ban Muslims, who sees women only as potential vessels for his "no problem there, I assure you," could be the president of the United States. It was the lead in July. It is the lead now. It will be the lead in November. Every interview with Donald Trump, every single one, should hold him accountable for bigotry, incitement, juvenile conduct, and blithe contempt for the Constitution. The voters will do what the voters will do, but it must not be, cannot be, because the press did not do enough. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Meera Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, and Dasha Lidzitsina. And our show was edited this week by our executive producer, Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Casey Holford. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.